How did the citizens of Cologne manage to gradually emancipate themselves from the archbishop? Cologne in 1265. The largest city in medieval Germany, trading houses, workshops, the Rhine full of ships, and above it all, the archbishop, who is not only their spiritual shepherd, but also the lord of the city. But the citizens, merchants, and patricians have long had their own ideas about how Cologne should be governed. For 300 years, tensions have been growing in the city between spiritual power and civic self-confidence. And before we get to the famous Battle of Worringen, the turning point in this development, let's take a look back today. How did an archiepiscopal metropolis slowly become a free city? The long road to urban autonomy, a retrospective on Cologne in the High Middle Ages. We haven't done what we are doing today for a long time. Whenever we conclude an era, we brought everyone up to the same level of knowledge here in the podcast. Looking back once again. Above all, to illustrate the longer lines of Cologne's city history, which of course often threaten to be lost when a single podcast episode covers only a specific event or biography in a short period of time, as is usually the case here. Do you remember the last retrospective, the last review here in the podcast? No? Well, it was a long time ago, almost 2 years have passed since we did that. At that time, we took another look at early medieval Cologne, and 3 years ago, we discussed the half millennium of Cologne's Roman era. Almost 300 years have passed since the death of Archbishop Brunn in 965 in this podcast. In our narrative, we had already reached the year 1265 in the last episode. One should celebrate occasions as they arise, says a German proverb. And since the centuries-long conflict over the rule in the city between wealthy citizens and the archbishop was soon to end in one of the greatest, I mean great in scale, not in being awesome, battles of the German Middle Ages, it is time to pause for a moment, to look back and outline the broad strokes again, once again. So I hope you'll join me, the long road to municipal freedom summarized here for you in a nutshell, or rather, the long road to Worringen. Hello and thank you very much for allowing me to take a summer break as usual. I hope you're all well and excited about what follows, and with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast you can listen as the city grows, from the Romans up until our present time. Perhaps you remember the previous retrospectives. It would be lazy and too simplistic to simply list everything that happened between 965 and 1265. If that were the case, you could just listen to the respective episodes again in order. No, we're not going to do that here. I have therefore decided to stick to a thematic thread here, the rise of the citizenry in Cologne. Disclaimer first. Entire generations of historians have struggled with the term citizen for that period. It is not always clear when, how, and what it meant to become or be a citizen. I too have avoided the topic as much as possible until now. But just as a reminder for us, not every inhabitant of Cologne in the Middle Ages and far beyond was automatically a citizen of the city of Cologne. What generally applies today to all German citizens living in Cologne was not the case back then. This legal status of being a citizen was linked to whether one was a man and had enough money or verifiable property. Men with citizenship rights were therefore far from being in the majority in Cologne. For the late Middle Ages, it is estimated that they made up around 16-30% of the male population only. However, we should never assume that the citizenry was a uniform group. Here, too, the dividing line within the group is not clear if we want to summarize conflicts over urban freedoms and rights as merely a struggle between the citizenry and the archbishop. From the 13th century onwards, in particular, there was a clear tendency among the richest and most influential citizens of the city, such as the Oberstolzens, to isolate themselves from the rest of the bourgeois urban society. They saw themselves as urban nobility, even though, with a few exceptions, they were not actually nobles. Those families that we generally refer to as patricians, in German we call them Geschlechter, constitute a minority within the citizenry of Cologne itself. However, they were a wealthy minority who could mobilize many people who were in some way dependent or connected to them and who were well connected within the empire, the church, and also abroad. It is precisely this small group that is usually at the center of the conflict. And it is precisely from this group, as well as from the circle around the archbishop, that the majority of the historical sources handed down to us originate. I don't want to stray too far into historical source criticism, even though it is essential. But Cologne's history, like historiography in general until we, well, into our time, is the history of the elites, the rulers, the property owners. This is not a judgmental statement, I just want to point it out again, or rather whisper it in your ear in this podcast. We simply do not know what the ordinary craftsman, the maid, the dock worker, or even the child growing up in Cologne between 965 and 1265 thought of all this, as much as I would like to bring their history to life. But well, so be it. Pro seminar over, let's get to the topic. When Bruno died in 965 as Archbishop of Cologne and Duke of Lorraine, he had left behind an enormous power base for the Archdiocese of Cologne for the next 800 years thanks to his close ties to the Ottonian imperial family. He was the younger brother of Emperor Otto I. For the first time, Bruno combined spiritual power as Archbishop over the Cologne church province with the secular power of the Duke of Lorraine. However, this development, whereby bishops exercised not only spiritual but also real political power, did not simply fall from the sky overnight, and Cologne and the Rhineland were not unique cases. Bishops in general had risen to become powerful secular rulers in the Middle Ages. Why was there no separation of church and state in the Middle Ages? Because it had never existed in Europe before. In the Roman Empire, the priests of Jupiter, Juno, Mars, and Minerva had even been civil servants to the state. Here the two were even more closely intertwined. The medieval empire and church also saw themselves as a single entity, although this would change significantly during the High Middle Ages, but that is another story. Above all, the question was which of the two was superior to the other. Our amazement at this not always uncomplicated symbiosis stems from our current worldview and our retrospective view of the past. The medieval emperor saw himself as a secular ruler and supreme Christian warrior. The bishops themselves did the same in a certain way. If, as a priest, I want to guide my congregation well through life so that they may go to heaven, I must also have political influence. Such thinking lies behind the idea of fulfilling this dual spiritual and secular role. The archbishop as a secular ruler of the city from the middle of the 10th century thus laid the foundation for the further course of Cologne's city history. The archbishop acted as the city's supreme judge, even having the power to pronounce death sentences. He was responsible for the city's coinage and custom laws, which had previously been a right of the emperor or king. Unfortunately, historical sources do not reveal the ambitions and ideas of the citizens regarding the political shape of the city over the following decades in the 10th century. Of course, we know more about the economic situation. Cologne's long-distance traders are gifted businessmen and travel to the markets of Europe that were accessible at the time. Their primary destinations are the present-day Netherlands and Belgium, which they reach via the motorway of medieval Germany, the Rhine River, and England, which they can reach via the North Sea. And here I would like to clarify one thing once again. For long periods of time, the citizens of Cologne and the archbishop seem to have worked well together. A win-win situation arose. The Cologne merchants brought money into the city, while the powerful imperial prince, in the form of the local archbishop, almost always a member of the Rhenish high nobility, provided military protection and intercession in other regions of the empire, up to the emperor king himself and far abroad. The archbishop became rich through taxes, levies, and loans received from the citizens of Cologne and long-distance traders, while in return, Cologne merchants were able to pursue their work in Europe under ideal conditions, often duty-free and in safety. The fact that there were also long periods of good cooperation is demonstrated by the oldest institution in the city known to us, in which Cologne citizens could be active, the Collegiate of Magistrates. Originally, they were servants from the Archbishop's circle, as well as wealthy Cologne merchants who were supposed to assist the Archbishop in reaching judgments in court on behalf of the city lord in a fraternal cooperative committee. However, by the 11th century, the magistrates who had sworn an oath to the Archbishop had quickly come to take on municipal tasks for the city lord as well. A city like Cologne cannot be governed and administered by a single man, like the Archbishop. The magistrates, initially only about a dozen men, were therefore happy to assist the city lord. However, this should not be confused with the city council that was to be established later. It is important. The development of municipal institutions is not always logical and cannot be compared to today in terms of the distribution and of tasks and hierarchy. Often responsibilities overlap or are disputed. Overlaps are very typical, as is the lack of clear demarcation from other institutions. Would you like an example? As a magistrate, you were always a member automatically of the Richterzeche, the privately organized brotherhood of welfare citizens. However, not every member of the Richterzeche was a magistrate. They could also be ordinary wealthy citizens, merchants, for example. Later, there were some who sat on the city council and were members of the Richterzeche, but did not belong to the Collegiate of Magistrates. You should actually be well versed in the Richterzeche and the later city council, but don't worry, I'll refresh our knowledge of these two words in a moment. Of course, it is also clear, and this is explained in detail here in the podcast, that the citizens and the Archbishop could sometimes be at loggerheads when it came to city rule. Were there disputes before? Certainly, but probably not as fierce as first time. The first known event in 1074. Thanks to the clergyman Lampert von Hersfeld, we learn from his chronicle that the situation could change explosively in a short period of time in Cologne. You are probably familiar with the story. Shortly after Easter 1074, Archbishop Anno II wanted to ensure that the Bishop of Münster had a pleasant journey home after celebrating the resurrection of Christ with the head of Cologne Church and City Lord. Entirely in keeping with his self-image as the supreme secular city lord, the Archbishop of Cologne had a fully loaded merchant ship belonging to a Cologne long-distance trader confiscated. The merchant's son resists, and a riot breaks out in the city, which takes a dramatic turn late that same night. Anno II, one of the most powerful men of his time, is forced to flee the besieged old Cologne cathedral under cover of darkness through a little hole in the city wall, like a hunted dog. And in this way, he probably escaped a violent death at the hands of the angry city mob. The story is a short episode. Despite the expulsion of the city's ruler from Cologne, Anno manages to raise an army in the Cologne area in no time at all and thus returns to the city. A spontaneous uprising, which appeared to be impulsive and not well thought out, lacked substance and probably had little support from the general population of the city. When Anno II stood before Cologne with his army, the rebels gave in. The rebellious merchants fled the city, or if they remained in the city, were violently whipped in public, and the ringleader, whose name is unknown to us, was even blinded. Historians have long debated whether the uprising of 1074 was the first rebellion of the citizenry against the archbishop's rule over the city. In Cologne's pop culture, this has long been the case. I too enjoy listening to the song by the Cologne band Blackfurs about a guy named Feschers Kürbis, which sings of the uprising. I would take a middle ground here. The 1074 uprising by a group of Cologne merchants against the Archbishop was a spontaneous act of discontent with the politics of the day. But the mere fact that they got together and wanted to fight for their rights, proverbially speaking, suggests that an awareness arose that they were a political actor in their own right as a city community, as citizens. Above all, I think, in my personal opinion, that looking back on 1074, people in Cologne certainly thought, huh, if we join forces, then we are not so powerless against the city ruler in the form of the Archbishop. The lesson was clear. Together, the citizens could make a difference, but how would they use this insight in the coming decades? Some 30 years later, we see that this way of thinking may have existed in people's minds. There were certainly two or three or even more contemporary witnesses to the events of 1074 when in 1106 people turned against the city ruler once again. This time not by force, but with the help of a third party, namely the emperor. The old emperor Henry IV, the very same who once went to Canossa to the Pope begging for mercy, fought against his own son, who conveniently was also named Henry and was therefore given the number 5. You know how the conflict ended, but what is important for us, turning to the king or emperor as a higher authority instead of the archbishop, had an effect. Against the archbishop's will, but through the higher emperor's intercession, the city of Cologne was allowed to expand for the first time since late antiquity, surrounding new areas with walls and integrating them into the city area. In 1106, these were areas west of Neumarkt Square around St. Apostles, as well as half of today's Eigelstein Quarter in the north, and the Weidmarkt Quarter district, and half of the Severins Viertel Quarter in the south as well. In the same century, between 1179 and 1180, the process was repeated. Once again, this was against the will of the Archbishop at the time, but with the permission of then-Emperor Barbarossa. However, it remains largely unknown to us who exactly the actors within the Cologne citizenry were, who focused on the construction of the wall. What we can observe, however, is from which committees the decision, such as the expansion of the city walls and boundaries, crystallized. For it is in the 12th century that we first hear the citizens of Cologne speak in the historical sources, immortalizing themselves in history. Let's take a short break and then continue straight away. In the first half of the 12th century, we learn for the first time about the so-called Riecherzeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich. This was first formed as a sworn community, probably during a renewed conflict against Henry V in Cologne. Cologne was thus in line with the general development of many cities in Europe, where sworn communities were formed as an expression of the citizens' desire to gain more political participation at the local level. The collegiate of magistrates did include wealthy Cologne citizens, but ultimately it was an instrument of power for the Archbishop of Cologne, with members sworn into it and to him. The Riecherzeche, though, was a private organization that acted like a government agency, but was not one in fact at all. At first glance, this sounds as if the Riecherzeche was a competitor to the older institution, the Collegiate of Magistrates. However, this was not the case at all. Every magistrate automatically became a member of this new Riecherzeche, this Brotherhood of the Rich. But Cologne's long-distance traders and other officials of the Archbishop were also members of it. The semi-legal Riecherzeche wisely kept the balance of power outside the sphere of influence of the Archbishop as Lord of the City, but not only accepting all magistrates into its ranks, but also stipulating that one of the two chairmen must always come from among the magistrates. These two chairmen of the Riecherzeche, who changed annually, had the title of mayor, which is misleading from today's perspective. However, as mentioned above, these two mayors were only the two mayors of the Riecherzeche and not of the city of Cologne. This is where the complicated web of overlapping, parallel and competing institutions mentioned at the beginning comes into play. In the course of the 12th century, the Riecherzeche acquired many municipal tasks and privileges, some of which it received directly from the Archbishop as a concession for other support for the city lord. It is reliably documented that from the middle of the 12th century onwards, the first city seal of Cologne was kept in the so-called House of the Rich on the Altermarkt Square. The Collegiate of Magistrates also met here, in this house, as each of its members was also a member of the Brotherhood of the Rich. In 1149, we also learn that the Richerzeche decided which professions were subject to guild membership. This meant that anyone who wanted to become a tailor, for example, had to belong to the Tailors Guild and submit to its rules and regulations. If you were not a member, you were not allowed to practice the profession of a tailor. This was pretty much the opposite of freedom of occupation, but totally normal in the Middle Ages in Europe. For ordinary people in Cologne, however, life took place on a completely different level. The everyday focal point was the neighborhood in which one lived, with its parish boundaries. Religious life was much more present at that time than even in the 1950s, when the majority of West Germans still attended Sunday services. There were many more religious holidays, especially in Holy Cologne, than there are today. And there was not just one Lent before Easter, but many more and longer ones. Religious life did not only take place on Sundays in church, but more generally in people's everyday lives. Processions ran through the streets, prayers were said at gatherings of all kinds, and many state tasks, such as the baptismal register, which was effectively the residence registration office at that time, were taken over by the local parish church. Parish church is a good keyword. In Cologne, the local neighborhood described above usually corresponded to one's own parish. On the outskirts of the city, especially in the areas incorporated in the 12th century, this was not always the case, but for the sake of simplicity, please, let's leave it at that for now. And it makes sense. If you are constantly attending religious festivals and services as a community, it is also the people there with whom you have the most contact. Many Cologne residents of that time therefore did not see themselves primarily as residents of Cologne, but as residents of St. Columba or St. Alban, in other words, the parish in which they lived. And so it is not surprising that it was precisely at this local level of the parishes that the lowest political levels of Cologne's inhabitants emerged, the so-called wards. It is important to note that although they were largely based on parish boundaries, they were not part of the church parish structure or part of the Archbishopric of Cologne. The wards must have existed sometimes before the Richerzeche and the Collegiate of Magistrates. It was probably their structure that inspired the Brotherhood of the Rich at the city level to be like that. Here too, a committee elected two mayors who changed annually. It should also be noted that these were the mayors of the respective ward and not the mayors of the city of Cologne as a whole. Neighborhood life was mostly regulated in the wards. Minor conflicts, such as neighborhood disputes, were settled here, but also, very importantly, the defense of the city was organized in the wards. In the event of an attack on the city, the bell was rung in the so-called Geburhaus, the neighborhood house of the ward. When the signal was given by the neighborhood, all men had to immediately arm themselves, get ready and report to the Geburhaus. Once everyone had gathered there, they would go to the city wall. Each ward had its own section of the wall to defend. The wards filled an important administrative gap at the local level. This was because the Archbishop's High Court, for example, in which the magistrates also participated, only met a few times a year and only ruled on the most serious crimes for which the death penalty could also be imposed. Everything else was dealt with by other courts, such as those in the wards. What made the wards even more special were their shrine cards. As early as the 12th century, the inhabitants of the wards recorded many of their legal transactions. These mainly concerned the sale and purchase of real estate. This means that we have preserved property registers, which is a stroke of luck for historical research. Although they are incomplete, as there was no obligation to record legal transactions here, they are still valuable. So let's recap. On the one hand, we have the Collegiate of Magistrates at the city level, which began as an archiepiscopal instrument of power in court and in the support of administrative tasks for the archbishop. Then there's the Richerzeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich, as an original sworn community of wealthy citizens. They are linked to both the rich merchants and the magistrates and their collegiate of it, and are increasingly beginning to act like a municipal authority, but one that is independent of the archbishop. At the local level, on the other hand, there were the wards, which were mostly based on the old and long-established parish boundaries. In a kind of neighborhood self-government, everyday matters were regulated and discussed here. All three had in common that they were organized internally by committees and fixed rules. The end of the 12th century and the rest of the 13th century were a period of ambivalent development for the archbishops of Cologne. One could almost say it was ironic. At the imperial level, it was a time when they accumulated a great deal of power. At the end of the 12th century, the Archbishop of Cologne, Philip von Heinsberg, had fought several wars against the once second most powerful ruler of the empire, Henry the Lion. In 1180, Henry the Lion was defeated and Emperor Barbarossa divided up his possessions. The Archbishop of Cologne emerged victorious. He received the Duchy of Westphalia. But at that very moment, his city of residence had taken action against him. Without his permission, they built what was then the largest medieval city wall in Europe. Emperor Barbarossa did give the Archbishop of Cologne the Duchy of Westphalia he so desperately wanted. However, he granted the citizens of Cologne the right to expand their city and gave them permanent control over these fortifications. The latter was a clear defeat for the archbishop, who had previously considered this to be his own right. Here too, the citizens of Cologne, in their quest for greater autonomy, used the emperor as a third party to get what they wanted. Around 1200, the German throne dispute began, and oh, I shudder when I hear that term, German throne dispute, you too. So let's keep it short. Unlike the 4.5 podcast episodes on the subject at the time, let's keep it short. In the dispute over succession to the imperial throne between the ruling Hohenstaufen and Guelph's dynasties, Cologne is an extremely fickle and active player. Depending on the political climate, the citizens take sides with the respective parties of the conflict, that of their own city lord, the Pope, the Guelphs, the Hohenstaufens, and even the English king, in order to gain privileges from everyone, rights and advantages. In the meantime, there's even a second Archbishop of Cologne alongside the incumbent Archbishop. Very confusing, let's skip that in the summary. What is important for us here? At the end of the conflict, the German throne dispute, Frederick II did cut back some of the city's freedoms, yes. But however, the fact that Cologne is now a city that issues documents on an equal footing with the Emperor, the Pope, the Archbishop and the English King, and pursues its own foreign policy independent of the city's ruler, is a development that cannot be reversed. And if one is in a direct relationship of loyalty to the Pope, or above all to the King / Emperor, is there really still a need for the Archbishop as a city lord at the intermediate level between the city and the head of the empire? This was a thought that would become increasingly prevalent in the 13th century. During this period, another political body of the city of Cologne emerged in 1215, a body that still exists today, the Cologne City Council. This made the existing ensemble of wards, Richterzeche and collegiate of magistrates even more complicated. However, it was abolished and banned in the same year by the new powerful Archbishop Engelbert II. But it was not until 1225, under his successor Heinrich von Müllenarch, often described in historical research as weak, that the city council was re-established. For me, the early council of the city of Cologne is something that reminds me of a minefield. I have tried so often to obtain information about it, but I still feel that my knowledge is not quite sufficient. In my view, as I understand it, the young Cologne city council fills the gap that exists between the actors in the wards and those at the civic helm of the city, for example in the Richterzeche and the Collegiate of Magistrates. So here, too, the city council was not founded to replace something, but to connect what already existed. In the 13th century, the members of the young city council were still made up of representatives from the wards, but it soon became apparent that the richest citizens of the city would soon set the tone here too. The central theme of this episode was the rise of the citizenry of Cologne. In the middle of the 13th century, this was a real back and forth. The new archbishop, Konrad von Hochstaden, granted the people of Cologne the right of staple. This made the city even richer than it already was for centuries to come. From then on, all traveling merchants had to stay in Cologne for 3 days and grant all Cologne citizens a right of first refusal. With its location on the Rhine, this was an unimaginable trading advantage for the largest city in medieval Germany. On the other hand, the conflicts between the city and its lord in 1252 and 1257 are no walk in the park. Wars and raids are fought particularly over legal issues and the minting of Cologne's coins. On both occasions, the renowned Dominican and scholar Albertus Magnus, one of the most important scholars of the Middle Ages, acts as a mediator. In both arbitration proceedings, the archbishop and the citizens acted as equals. However, on both occasions, the arbitration rulings did not hold. The dispute broke out again. Through a clever maneuver, Archbishop Konrad exploited the dissatisfaction of the craftsmen, who did not feel fully represented by the patrician leadership. This was a preview of further conflicts within the city for the 14th century. With this revolution from above, the archbishop deposed the previous patrician magistrates, had their leaders arrested, or forced them into exile. It seemed as if every success that the citizens of Cologne had achieved since 1074 had been wiped out in one fell swoop. But Konrad von Hochstaden died 2 years after his coup, and we are currently dealing with his successor, Engelbert von Falkenburg. He acted so clumsily and openly hostile that he turned even the craftsmen's guilds, which had previously been on his side, against him. In constant conflict with the city, he gradually lost control of it. You learned exactly how this happened in the episodes preceding this retrospective, and hopefully it is still fresh in your minds. Well, this turned out to be much longer than expected. But then again, the density of historical sources is becoming, well, denser. And with that, there's always more to tell. Everything we've heard today leads to the question, will Cologne finally manage to get rid of the archbishop? The answer comes in Vorringen, when a big battle will take place there. In the next episode, we will discuss how the wealthy citizens did not always present a united front. Until now, the Weiss family from the Mühlengasse was Cologne's most powerful family, particularly due to their influence in the collegiate of magistrates. However, a new patrician family, the Overstolzen family, cleverly allied with other families in the cities, and they are pushing their way to the top. Who will win from both sides? We will find out in the next episode when the streets in the south of Cologne become a battlefield. And of course, the old Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg is there once again, hoping to conquer Cologne militarily again, even though he himself is still sitting in prison at this point. Thank you very much for listening. Recommend me further, and as always, auf Wiedersehen.